people, people with immune conditions, people with chronic conditions. This is what the Israelis count on to force people into the concentration camp. However, they are so incapable of even pretending for one moment that they would treat anybody humanely, that I think based on what we see from the GHF, Palestinians are nowhere near falling for this trap.
Finally, like every other doctor who's worked in Gaza, you work and you've treated children. There's a new acronym that has been coined since Israel's siege of the territory, WCNSF, Wounded Child, No Surviving Family. Can you end by telling us some of their stories?
Yeah, I will. You know, I always thought that Palestine was something that I needed to understand what else was going on in the world. What I've come to understand and see by stories like Wounded Child, No Surviving Family, is that Palestine is the central issue, not just of our time, but of the past 100 years. Everything we see happening in Palestine, like the treatment these children are receiving, is what's going to happen in every other domain. And that's, you know, an idea, not one that I've come up with, but that talented analysts and historians have been talking about for a while, such as Dr. Guicciardo or Dr. Poder, who both analyze these and talk about them. In terms of wounded children, basically what we see a lot of the time, what I've stopped doing for the past several months now, I've stopped asking any child I see about whether they're there with somebody or whether there's anybody there for them. You know, it gets so busy. We get literally dozens of patients at a time because of these massacres. And so sometimes we need somebody to go grab blood for this little 2-year-old or 1-year-old who's on the floor. And when I ask, you know, where's this boy's family? Where's this girl's family? Often I get the same acronym back. Dr. Tariq, this is a wounded child, no surviving family. And so we try to treat them. They're often too young to understand that their parents are dead, but they sit there struggling, wounded. You know, we've seen so many, we've seen a flood of videos. Like, for example, just 2 days ago, a child who I saw who had more than half of her body surface area burned, and where I was looking for somebody to comfort her, and there was simply nobody. And so I picked her up and just held her for a few minutes, until there was somebody else who could come to hold her so I could go back to treating my other patients. All I could think is that this story, there are tens of thousands at this point of people, of children in Gaza who've lost one or both of their family. Understanding what's happening to them is understanding war as it's being proposed for the rest of the world.
Dr. Tariq Labani, I want to thank you for being with us. Palestinian-Canadian doctor, emergency room medical physician, volunteering at Nasser Hospital in Gaza since June. Medical director of the GLIA Project, an organization creating open-source medical devices for low-resource settings. Coming up, how Netanyahu prolonged the war in Gaza to stay in power. That's the headline of a new New York Times investigation. We'll speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Ronen Bergman, back in 20 seconds. Something to Say by Fatoumata Diawara, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. How Netanyahu prolonged the war in Gaza to stay in power. That's the headline of a new investigation in the New York Times Magazine published Friday. The co-authors write, quote, "Why, after nearly 2 years, has the war yet to reach a definitive conclusion? Why did Israel frequently turn away chances for de-escalation, instead expanding its military ambitions to Lebanon, to Syria, now to Iran? Why has the war dragged on even as the leadership of Hamas was decapitated and more Israelis called for a ceasefire?" Unquote. The authors write they interviewed over 110 officials in Israel, the U.S., and the Arab world, in addition to reviewing scores of government documents and records to investigate these questions. They go on to say Netanyahu, quote, "When an extended ceasefire was finally forged in January, he broke the truce in March, in part to keep his coalition intact. The cost of delay has been high. With each passing week, the delay has meant death to hundreds of Palestinians and horror to thousands more. It also meant at least 8 more hostages died in captivity," unquote. We're joined now by Ronen Bergman. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning Israeli investigative reporter and staff writer for The New York Times Magazine, co-author of this piece in the magazine. Can you lay out your findings, Ronen, how Netanyahu prolonged the war in Gaza to stay in power?
Thank you, Amy. I think it's, of course, very hard to differentiate between the different vectors in such a, it's not just the war in Gaza. It's a regional war, something that started with Hamas attacking Israel on October 7th, and Hezbollah attacking Israel on October 8th, and then it erupted to a regional war. And some of the things that Netanyahu has done, I think any Israeli prime minister would do, countering, of course, following Hamas horrific attack. But some of what he did was clearly motivated, at least partly, by his coalition motivation and his fear of the integrity of the coalition. His coalition is dependent on the ultra-right parties that again and again threaten Netanyahu that if he goes for a deal, if he goes for a ceasefire that will bring back the hostages, a ceasefire that could bring, you know, a new page to this so painful bloody war, if he does that, then they will disassemble the government. One of the scenes that we are describing, this is just a case study, together with my colleagues, the Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times, Patrick Kingsley, and the reporter for the New York Times in Jerusalem, Nathan Odenheimer, is happening in April 24. You just quoted something that happened almost a year after, which repeated that. But in April 24, Benjamin Netanyahu, together with his small cabinet and national security and military advisors, agreed to a deal that would put the war to a halt. It would have weeks of ceasefire. It will have an exchange of Palestinian prisoners for Israeli hostages. And it will bring hope for negotiation, for cessation of hostilities, withdrawal of the Israeli military, and possibly also something that Netanyahu has thrived for many, many years to get, and was the closest of any prime minister, which is the normalization of relations with the most important Arab country, Saudi Arabia, that was willing to do that. He was about to bring this to the larger cabinet. He says to advisors, "I'm not putting this on the agenda. I want to put this as a surprise, or not to let the more extremist ministers to oppose and coordinate." And when he was just about to do that, the Ministry of Treasury, Bezalel Smotrich, one of the ultra-right members of the cabinet, entered the room, bursting, and said, "Prime Minister, I heard that you are going to put a proposal for a ceasefire." The details bothered him, and he says, "I just wanted you to know, Prime Minister, I wanted you to know that if you do that, you do not have a government," meaning that they will leave the coalition and it will be disassembled. And Netanyahu said, no, I was not going to put anything on the table. And he whispered to his aides, "Don't put this offer forward." This happened in a time when it was not just sabotaging the possible hostage deal and a possible ceasefire deal. Of course, ending the misery of the hostages, of the millions of Palestinians, bringing back the hostages, saving the life of many Israeli soldiers, and maybe be a page turn to a better future for the region. But it could also bring normalization for Netanyahu, something that he really wanted. Now, Amy, it's not that Netanyahu doesn't want the hostage to come back. It's not that Netanyahu doesn't want normalization with Saudi Arabia. He does, I'm sure. But there are things he wants more, or maybe more precisely, things that he fears more. And that is the integrity of the coalition. And repeatedly, again and again, Prime Minister Netanyahu put the integrity of the coalition, the safety of his continuous rule of the government and the state, well, he's up on severe corruption charges. He put this as a first priority ahead of any other priority.
So just today, he was back in court after coming to the United States, back in an Israeli court, saying, you know, he should not be tried because he has to deal with national security issues. You write, for Netanyahu, the immediate rewards of not having a peace deal have been rich. He's amassed more control over the Israeli state than at any other point in his 18-year tenure as prime minister. He successfully prevented a state inquiry that would investigate his own culpability, saying the fallout must wait until the Gaza war ends. Even as the defense minister, army chief, domestic spy master, and several top generals all either have been fired or have resigned. And you talk about how he attends court up to three times a week for his corruption trial. His government now moving to fire the attorney general who oversees the prosecution. If you can go more into that and investigation into how October 2023 happened with Netanyahu himself approving millions of dollars brought in, what, by Qatari officials to Gaza to support Hamas.
Yeah. Let me start with the latter, with your permission, Amy. Netanyahu said publicly and privately for years that he sees Hamas as an asset. How come? Because once you have Hamas, an extreme jihadist fundamentalist regime in Gaza that does not recognize the right of Israel to exist, and now we see from Hamas secret protocols that were all about eradicating the state of the Jews. They wanted to destroy Israel. They wanted to coordinate a regional war. Once you have something like that in Gaza, Netanyahu can say to the world, why do you want me to negotiate with the Palestinians? How can I negotiate with the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank when you have something, such an entity in Gaza? And he saw Hamas as an asset. He convinced the Qataris to funnel many, many hundreds of millions of dollars to help the Hamas government in Gaza, to help them survive. While at the same time, as we uncover, during the last year since he became prime minister again in early 23, and until the war, he pushed back again and again and again on any idea of his military chiefs and the leaders of the intelligence community to confront Hamas, to assassinate their leaders. As late as October 1st, so a week before Hamas attack, he pushed back on ideas to confront Yihya Sinwar, the mastermind behind October 7, and said, you should keep them quiet. I have other priorities like the normalization with Saudi Arabia. So the bottom line, his willingness to not just let Hamas thrive, but help Hamas thrive, not in order not to force him to have international pressure to negotiate two-state solution, led to Hamas fortified its rule and secretly planning the October 7th surprise. Now, after the October 7th surprise, everybody was sure that Netanyahu is going to be ousted, he's going to be expelled from politics after bringing a year of an attempt to weaken the judiciary, to fire the attorney general, what he's trying to do now as well, after a year of weakening the military that was, you know, divided and disassembled in some of its units because of the judicial overhaul. Everybody thought, was sure that he's going down in politics. That's the end of his political career. But Netanyahu prevailed. He used smart, sophisticated, sometimes brutal, sometimes inhonest politics, together with sophisticated propaganda machine working in Israel. Together with confronting the judicial system, he promised to make himself available for his trial, but then when the trial came, he's doing or using any excuse not to be there. And at the peak of that, And I think this is the biggest triumph of his career. He was able to flip the war, hit Hezbollah, and you know, we have to mention the fact that Hezbollah was the first to launch unprovoked attack on Israel. And then, and this is maybe the peak of his diplomatic and political career, convinced President Trump just recently on their call on June 9th to agree that Israel will strike Iran, and then to convince President Trump to join the strike when sending the B-2 to bomb the Iranian nuclear sites.
Ronan, we just have 30
after
2 seconds.
Years, he's almost... Sorry?
We just have 30 seconds. Go ahead.
I'm saying, and now after 2 years, he is stronger than ever since October 7th, and some say maybe even strong enough after all that happened to re-win the elections. And it's not a coincidence that he's trying to weaken the gatekeepers and fire all of them just before maybe announcing elections.
Ronan Bergman, I want to thank you for being with us. Israeli Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New York Times, co-authored the investigation in the magazine How Netanyahu Prolonged the War in Gaza to Stay in Power. His book is titled Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. Coming up, we speak to the mayor of Oxnard and a migrant rights activist about the immigration raids this weekend, where a farm worker has died of his injuries and hundreds have been rounded up. Back in 20 seconds.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Living is easy with eyes closed. Misunderstanding all we see. It's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me. Déjame llevar.
La Santa Cecilia playing their rendition of Strawberry Fields Forever, a tribute to migrant workers in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to California, where a farm worker who fell from the roof of a greenhouse during an immigration raid last week died over the weekend of his injuries. 57-year-old Jaime Alanis had worked at the farm in Camarillo for 10 years, providing for his wife and daughter who live in Mexico. His niece says he'll now be laid to rest in his hometown of Michoacán. Jaime Alanis is the first known person to die during an immigration raid since Trump returned to office. He reportedly called his family during the raid to tell them he was hiding before falling about 30 feet from the roof. The raid there Thursday led to an hours-long standoff between protesters and federal border agents who blocked the roads with military-style vehicles and tear gas, community members, including children, as crowds attempted to protect dozens of farm workers from arrest. This is one of the protesters.
These guys showed up all tough, cowards, and they've already tried to push us out. But there's more of us here now than there were before. At the end of the day, they're the ones coming from over there. They're not from here. Farmers who work here take more of a beating than anyone else. They're not the ones who deserve this f***ing treatment.
The Department of Homeland Security said over 300 immigrants were detained in dual raids on cannabis farms and agricultural fields in Camarillo and the coastal city of Carpinteria. Among those taken into custody were at least 14 immigrant children. The United Farm Workers Union issued a statement in response saying, quote, farm workers are excluded from basic child labor laws, and it's unfortunately not uncommon for teenagers to work in the fields. To be clear, detaining and deporting children is not a solution for child labor, they said. This comes as a federal judge in Los Angeles Friday issued an order temporarily blocking the Trump administration from conducting sweeping immigration raids and racially profiling people in Los Angeles and surrounding areas. Judge Mame Wusemensa Frimpong said agents are prohibited from targeting people based on their apparent ethnicity, the language they're speaking, their presence at a particular location, or the type of work they're engaged in. The judge also ordered immigration authorities to provide anyone they arrest with immediate access to lawyers. one of the plaintiffs in the case, Brian Gavidia, who was aggressively pushed against a fence by ICE agents during a raid and questions as he repeatedly told the agents he was a U.S. citizen, spoke at a news conference Friday.
I truly believe that. I believe in the Constitution. I believe in America. I believe in what we stand. I believe in this court system. And I believe that what's going down right now in the United States is wrong. I believe in the Constitution. We are ignoring the Constitution at the very moment. It is not right. We will not stand down. We are all Americans here. We will not allow this to happen. We follow the Constitution.
For more, we're joined by two guests. Angel Marie Taylor is an undergraduate student in her senior year at California State University, Channel Islands, a volunteer with 805 Immigrant Coalition. 805 Immigrant Coalition was present during the federal immigration raid in Camarillo. And Lewis MacArthur is mayor of Oxnard, California, about 10 miles from Camarillo. He was previously the police commander of Oxnard and worked on the police force there for 35 years, now speaking out against the ICE raid, saying they're, quote, aggressive, demonstrating insensitivity toward the direct impact on our community. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Angel Marie Taylor. Describe the raid that you saw. You are an eyewitness.
It was almost unlike anything that we had ever seen before. Most of the protesters out there are your average people. We are average community members who have been volunteering our time to patrol our own streets to keep each other safe from these ICE agents, ICE thugs, I would say, who have been operating entirely outside of the law, not identifying themselves, not allowing us our rights. And that's just us as protesters who come to witness and document these raids. That's not even to speak to the even more intense violence that the farm workers themselves experience in the blocked off area. As you mentioned, where over 300 people from our community were taken.
And Mayor, if you can talk about what is happening, you're the former police chief. Now you are the mayor of Oxnard. In a social media post, you wrote, "While this matter is taking place outside the jurisdiction of Oxnard, I'm increasingly mindful that many of the facility's employees are likely from Oxnard and are seeking refuge in their vehicles amidst the high temperatures, raising concerns about the safety and well-being of those individuals." Can you talk about the Oxnard residents, Lewis MacArthur, who were targeted?
Yes, absolutely. You know, what we're seeing is these unjust and harmful actions by ICE officials without following any due process. And we had it hit home here on several instances. As you may know, Oxnard is the largest city in Ventura County. Ventura County has about 830,000 residents. Oxnard has about a quarter of those residents. And many of them, when I heard about what was unfolding there at the Glass House in Camarillo, which is right next door to us, just a few miles away, I know, having grown up here in Oxnard, the many of the individuals that worked at the Glass House were Oxnard residents. And so that's what caused me to turn back around. I was headed to Los Angeles to come back and to be present. And what I also saw is just a lot of insensitivity. I was personally receiving phone calls because my cell phone number was shared from people that were inside the facility that were taking refuge in their cars and with the sun as strong as it was that day. And the number of hours that the operation lasted, it became very evident as to what I had stated previously, that these actions are very harmful to our community, to individuals. We're talking about human beings. We're talking about parents, just like the gentleman that passed because of the chaotic actions of ICE. I'm not saying that the ICE agents killed the gentleman, but because of the chaotic actions, they caused this man and others to seek refuge, and this man fell down from the roof head first, from what I understand, and died as a result of that. And then we had people that actually sought refuge as well, not only in their cars, but also on the dirt field and cover themselves up with dirt. And that was information that was being relayed or trying to be relayed to these ICE agents. But the fact that they work in secrecy without a person willing to interact while I was there on site, there was no deliberate intent by anyone from ICE to come out and just engage in some dialogue with us so that we can relay this information. There was none of that. And that's what we're talking about. It's just a lack of due process. And as I have asserted, like any other police officer with the tenure of time that I spent in the police force, I've arrested some of the most just persons that had committed atrocious crimes in our city, from murderers to folks that have sexually assaulted others, and just a number of other felonious crimes. But nonetheless, those individuals were afforded a due process following the 5th and 14th Amendment of our Constitution. They were afforded the right to see an attorney, to consult with an attorney, to stand before a judge, and to be made available an opportunity to defend themselves. And that's not what we're seeing now. We're seeing people quickly being expedited out of here. And that's why the errors are occurring. And for us as a community, what it's doing, not only is it impacting our economy, but it's directly impacting children who are oftentimes left with our mom and dad here to care for them. And this is putting a tremendous amount of strain. We're seeing a lot of nonprofits come out and help and stepping up. But we can't endure this much longer.
Mayor,
and this is what we've been done.
I want to go to Angel Marie Taylor. You're an undergraduate student in your senior year at California State University. On Thursday, you were at the raid with John Carvalho, a faculty member at your university who was arrested and remains detained. I want to turn to him speaking the night before the raid, Wednesday, at the Camarillo City Council meeting's public comment period.
My name is John Caravello, and I'm a professor at CSU Channel Islands. I'm also a longtime organizer with Ventura County Tenants Union, and more recently a volunteer with VC Defensa. Many of my students are undocumented, and many of their families are undocumented. It's my responsibility to protect them, and so I've been patrolling the city streets, following armed, masked thugs trying to kidnap my neighbors. Many call these neighbors illegal, but let's talk for a second about what's really illegal. When the U.S. bombed civilian nuclear sites like they did in Iran late last month, it's illegal. When the U.S. provides weapons to an apartheid state to fuel a genocide like it continues to do in Palestine, it is illegal. And today, armed mass thugs are bending the knee to just follow orders to kidnap, imprison, and deport our neighbors to countries that we destabilize, that we have under the thumb of our political and economic domination, whose soil we destroy with pesticide-ridden bananas, whose leaders we depose, and whose people our media continue to dehumanize. Who are we to constrict the movement of our fellow human beings? Who are we to judge how people choose to live? ICE is not welcome here, just like the U.S. is not welcome in other countries. And you, our elected officials, should swear them off, if not in policy, then in spirit, to at the very least pay back your undocumented community members for picking your strawberries. No one is illegal. Power to the people.
So that is John Caravello, who is a faculty member at California State University, Channel Islands, where Angel Marie Taylor, you teach. He was arrested the next day. We just have 30 seconds. He hasn't been released yet?
No, Professor Caravello hasn't been released. And as you've heard in that public comment, he has always used his voice to speak up for those around him. Myself as a student coming from an immigrant background, like most other students here in CSU Channel Islands, Professor Caravello has been continuously targeted because of his outspoken views to defend his community. And he was one of the protesters on the ground who was helping other protesters amidst the violence.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to cover this. As the judge in Los Angeles ruled that migrants can no longer be rounded up in Los Angeles without cause, Angel Marie Taylor, student and volunteer with 805 Immigrant Coalition, thank you for being with us. And Luis MacArthur, mayor of Oxnard, 10 miles from Camarillo, previously the police commander of Oxnard. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. We strive to provide perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media. If you'd like to know more about us, check out our website at cjsf.ca.
Hey, do you want to make a real impact in the Black community? Join us where we connect you with Black-led organizations from all around the world. Get ready to get involved. Find the organization based on the location of interest. Follow us at Support Black Charity.
The Canadian